Lesson number 24 in the book of 1 Samuel. We had just ended very quickly, in fact, in the last lesson, that there were no blacksmiths. Blacksmiths were not allowed in the land, and the Philistines were the ones who had not permitted the blacksmiths to be in the land of Israel. And King Saul, even though he was in his second year as king, had not been able to reestablish the blacksmiths in the promised land because the Philistines are basically still in control. And they are coming back at him with a vengeance. And Saul has not run out these Philistines. And they will not be run out, by the way, until the ark is returned. And a battle occurs just after the ark is returned. And Samuel places the Ebenezer stone. And the Philistines are now totally out of control of the nation of Israel. And Saul is going to be in control. Well, what that means is Saul is going to reign for about 27 years as king and not have total control over the land of Israel. So because we left off on the deal where there are no blacksmiths in the land of Israel, we do not want to think about the importance of blacksmith anymore here in America, but I want to just talk to you about that just a moment. Until the industrial age came along in America, blacksmiths were the backbone of every community. It is where the tools of the trade were crafted and maintained. This include the plows, the pitchforks, the axes, the hammers, the hardware for the yoke of the oxen, and much, much more. A blacksmith and carpenters, all those two trades were the backbone that allowed the agriculture, food to be grown and everything. They were what kept the ability to grow food and feed the land. They were the backbone. The Philistines had regulated all the work of the blacksmith to the Philistines who lived down in the Philistine districts. So as the text just told us in our last lesson, at the end of our last lesson, if you wanted to have your plow sharpened, you had to take it down into the Philistine area to get it sharpened down there because the Philistines were in control of all of this. And by the way, the charge to sharpen any tool was exorbitant. It was 2/3 of a shekel to sharpen each tool. That's exorbitant. Basically, what we're saying is it was virtually out of the financial means of most families at the time of Samuel and Saul to go have their dull tools sharpened. But yet, a dull tool is almost worthless, by the way. It makes the work harder. So tools provided the produce for the family farm to provide for the family, and so therefore, if money was spent at a blacksmith down in the Philistine area, it was no doubt spent on the tools instead of other items, because they needed those tools to be sharp in order to have a good produce. So what was the result of the Philistine plan that rid the promised land of all the blacksmiths? What's the result of that? We're in chapter 13 of 1 Samuel, verse number 22. The need for tools overrode the need for weapons, and that's the result. There were no weapons in Israel. Verse number 22. So it came about on the day of the battle that neither sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and his son Jonathan. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. Okay, if the people of Israel did not have weapons, where did the six, I'm talking about all the nation of Israel didn't have weapons. However, the 600 men with Saul at Gilgal and the 1,000 men with Jonathan, they had weapons. Where did they get those weapons? Well, more than likely, they gathered and secured those weapons from the dead Ammonites of the battle that had occurred shortly before this time in the storyline of the Jabesh-Gilead battle. They got them from their cousins, the Ammonites. Remember Nahash, who wanted to pluck out the eyes of the Jabesh-Gileads and make that covenant? And Saul went in just the year before and fought them. And so he picked out his army. He probably picked out the best men. Saul picked out the best men, the 3,000 men who could serve, who had weapons. And they got those weapons from the Ammonites. All right. They were spoils of war. It was probably an unexpected windfall for Israel that the Philistines had not foreseen, because they had hamstrung the Israelites to where they had to decide, do we sharpen our plow or do we sharpen our sword? And a dull sword was no good. So they had their plows sharpened and their axe sharpened and their fork sharpened, but not their swords. Now the passive mikmash is also mentioned here, is mentioned in Isaiah chapter 10, verse number 29. And that passive mikmash, and I have a picture here for you to see it, is spoken about over in Isaiah when Sennacherib marched his army towards Jerusalem, and that's mentioned there. And that occurred about 722 BC. So our story, where we're situated now, is about 1047 BC, and about 325 years later is going to be the Sennacherib story in 722 BC. So nevertheless, from the Isaiah passage, we know that the pass of Michmash was a deep ravine, or ravine now identified as the Wadi Es Shuinit. Now, somewhere along this deep ravine that you see here, okay, this deep ravine, that's water going down on the left-hand side of that picture, and that's a rise on the mountain on the other side of the hill, on the left side of the picture, somewhere along this deep ravine, there's a place that is safe to cross and to exit across from Michmash. Now, the Philistines probably used the crossing as a way for their three companies to march out to their assigned locations, one to go east, one to go north, and one to go west, that we mentioned in chapter 13, where we are, verses number 17 and 18. Well, it's interesting because that's where the writer leaves us to tell us about this pass at Michmash. So as the writer takes us into chapter 14, the scene is set. So let us review the scene again. Saul had traveled from Gilgal to the outskirts of Gibeah with his army, with about 600 men. The writer has not told us the detail yet, but he still will tell us that in verse number 2 of chapter 14. Jonathan and the army of about 1,000 men with him are at Geba. The Philistines had assigned three companies of men and dispatched them in three locations, or towards three locations. One company was sent west to be stationed on the way towards the village of Beth Haran, which sat in the land of Ephraim. Now, they didn't go to Ephraim. They just went towards that area. So they went, they left Michmash and went west. The company did not exit the tribal area of Benjamin. One company, another company, was sent northward towards Ophrah. They didn't get to Ophrah. They were on the road to Sheol. And so that company did not go to Ophrah. It simply was mentioned, Ophrah simply mentioned to tell us that's the direction that they went. And the third company left Michmash and went towards the valley of Zeboim, which is east towards the Jordan River. Finally, the rest of the Philistines that were left, they moved from Michmash to the pass of Michmash, which was like this crossing in this deep ravine, wherever it is. Now, in essence, the whole of Benjamin's tribal area was invaded by the Philistines. That's what he's trying to tell us. North Benjamin land, east Benjamin land, west Benjamin land, central Benjamin land is covered with Philistines. Okay. What is happening here, it was the smallest of the tribal areas of all the tribes of Israel. And so to have these four positions threaten the life and the work of the people who were in the land of Benjamin. Why was this concentration of Philistines in this little tribal area of Benjamin in the first place? It was because right there, they're the capital of the nation of Israel. The capital seat of Saul's kingdom was there in Saul's hometown of Gibeah. in that tribal area. If they could capture the capital, they could have the nation. If the Philistines could control and have dominance in and over the promised land, they had to defeat King Saul, and they had to defeat him in his capital area, because that's where they thought Saul was. To do that, the Philistines had to defeat him where he was located. And our writer now tells us the story of the secret plan of Saul's son Jonathan, and how Jonathan kept the secret hidden from the king. Can you believe it? Now this writer has told us about no weapons and all of that, and now he's telling us about Jonathan's secret plan. Chapter 14, verse number 1. Now the day came that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the Philistine garrisons that is on the other side." But he did not tell his father. It seems that Jonathan knew that his nation needed vital information about the location of the Philistines. To gather that information, Jonathan wanted to take a look for himself, and he wanted his servant, his armor bearer, with him as he went to spy on the Philistines. The higher up in the rank of an army, the more privileges were afforded to the higher up person. In Jonathan's case, he was probably considered a higher up because he was the king's son. Therefore, he was afforded a servant to carry his heavy armor as they traveled. He had armor, meant he was old enough to be in the army. We need to insert a few facts at this point. For a regular warrior of this time, the warrior's armor was simply his weapon, or his weapons. It could be a sword. It could be a bow and arrow. It could be a spear or a javelin. It could be an axe, maybe a shield, maybe a pitchfork, something of sorts. Possibly he had some leather protection of some sort for his forearms, his elbows, and his knees. This extra equipment that the armor bearer carried was not only the equipment for his master, but also he acted, when he carried his equipment, his armor, he carried the things that were extensions of his arms. Now, one of the interesting things that's very important to you know at this point in time, this is not in your notes, but I'm going to tell you here. Even in the days of Solomon, which he's going to come 80 years later after this, or almost 90 years later after this, your arms and your legs were both called legs. There wasn't a name for legs, and there wasn't a name for arms. Both of the appendages of your arms and your legs were called legs. And what you held in your hand was your armor, your sword or your spear was your armor. So when we're talking about being an armor bearer, he carried what was the extension of the leg that became the deadly force in battle, the armor. Now, in my book of my commentary in Ecclesiastes that I wrote with John Phillips, to finish John Phillips's commentary in the Exploring Ecclesiastes, I explain this in detail, and I encourage you to go get the book and to buy that book and to read it. It's a very enlightening book on the book of Ecclesiastes. Brings out many things. But what we're saying here is this armor bearer carries the armor, but he also carries other things for the master. He carries things like the food. He carries things like, he's the butler, in other words. He carries the clothing. He carries he's the bodyguard, and he's the bodyguard to the master, and he's also, most of the time, in many cases, he is the most trusted ally of the master and possibly the master's closest friend. So at this time, Jonathan's armor bearer must have afforded many of the same benefits as the as his master for himself and for his family. So in other words, this armor bearer is always with Jonathan. And as such, this armor bearer could be in the same peril as his master if things did not go well. So in this passage, Jonathan had a plan. And he wanted his closest friend and his war companion to be with him. He said to his armor bearer, his companion, he said this, "Come, let us cross over to the Philistine's garrison that is on the other side." But he did not tell his father. You see, it was his secret plan. It may have been a dangerous plan, and it was a secret plan. And not only was Jonathan's plan hidden from his father, the king, but get this, it was also hidden from the people of the warriors, the 1,000 men who were with Jonathan. Verse number 2, chapter 14. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. And the people who were with him were about 600 men. And Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the priest of the Lord at Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Between the passes by which Jonathan sought to cross over to the Philistine garrison, there was a sharp crag on the one side and a sharp crag on the other side. And the name of one was Bozes, and the name of the other was Sinib. And one crag rose on the north opposite Michmash, and the other on the opposite Geba. Now, we have much to discover in this passage. Much to discover. First of all, even though Saul was near his hometown in his capital city, he was not at home. He and his warriors and his warrior men were camped outside the city. Saul's tent was set under the pomegranate tree, which is at Migron. We do not know the location of this fruit tree. Therefore, we do not know the location of Migron beyond it being mentioned here in this verse, but we know it's outside of Gibeah. So it must, because it's mentioned here, the Israelites must have known it very well at that time when they would have been reading this later on in the years, even in the days of Solomon and after that. They would have known where it was. It would have not have been included in this record, I do not believe, of the Acts of the Kings if it wasn't well known at the time of the Hebrews who lived there. Second, the writer confirms at this time that Saul had not recouped the warriors. Remember, he had 2,000 with him, but some of them abandoned him at Gilgal, and his company was now, according to this verse, only the 600 men who were left, who did not run away with the others from Saul at Gilgal. So they had moved with him to the outskirts of Gibeah. But the writer tells us a little more about who was with him, and Saul had a possible future high priest with him by the name of Ahijah, okay? He's a possible future high priest. He is not yet a priest. He was still just a young man. He was the great-grandson of Eli, the high priest at the time, who was still wearing the ephod at the tabernacle in Shiloh. And even though we have already been told the story of Eli's death and the death of Phinehas and Hophni and Phinehas, his sons, even though we've been told that, we're not at that point in this timeline, in this timeline. We are not there yet. Eli and Phinehas were not dead at this time. They will not die for another 26 years or 25 years into the story. Eli was still the high priest. He was about 72 years old. Phinehas was probably about 56 years old. That's a guesstimate. He was still a worthless son of Eli, and he had not, and Eli had not corrected him from doing the bad things that he was doing. So he's going to be punished by the Lord with his death. And with the loss of the line of the high priest of Israel forever. But this passage also tells us that Phinehas had a son named Abitub. Abitub could not have been over 40 years of age. So his son, Ahijah, could probably be no older than 20, 22 years of age. He's not old enough to be in the priestly training yet, because the priestly training didn't start until they were age 25. So he's definitely not a priest, because he can't do that until he's age 30. Now Ahijah will be the brother of Ichabod. That's interesting. He's going to be the brother of Ichabod, because Ichabod was not to be born for another 26 years. So Ichabod is going to be born on the day that Eli and Phinehas died, and as well as on the day that his mother dies, giving him birth. So the purpose this writer is telling us to mention Ichabod was simply to establish a point here. He's establishing the relationship for all of Israel to remember Ahijah was the grandson of Phinehas, and the great-grandson of Eli. So in summary, let me sum it up to you like this. I know that was a lot of stuff there. He said, at this point in the passage in the timeline, Eli is still the high priest, Phinehas is still a priest, and doing his sinful things with the offerings and with the women at the tabernacle complex. And Phinehas' son, Abitub, was a priest, and his son, Ahijah, was not old enough to start the priestly training, but was old enough to join the warriors in Saul's army, because he's over 20. So again, for clarity, it is not telling us that Ahijah was old enough to enter the priesthood training at age 25 or become a full-fledged priest at the age of 30. Okay, so before moving on in the details of this passage, let us address the work of the ephod worn by Eli, okay, the high priest over at the tabernacle complex. We must remember from past studies that we have done that the ephod was the official robe used by the high priest at the tabernacle complex when officiating the duties of the offerings. Simply wearing the robe did not mean that that man in the robe was the high priest. The ephod belonged to the high priest and was his official garment, but it would be worn by others too, and let me explain. A priest was on duty at the tabernacle complex 24 hours a day. A priest was always awake and on duty every moment of every day. There was always someone on duty 24 hours a day. When the high priest was on duty, he wore the ephod robe. But when he was off duty, one of his descendants, who was a priest, who was at least 30 years of age, would take and put on, and who was fully trained, would put on that high priest ephod and act as a substitute high priest. To say that another way, the high priest was not always on duty at the tabernacle, but his ephod was never off duty. Every moment of every day since the ephod was dedicated during the erection of the tabernacle complex under the direction of Moses and recorded in the book of Leviticus, the ephod was never out of service to the Lord. Someone was wearing it before the Lord always. This priest, who was over 30 years of age and wore the ephod, would have been in the line of Eli going back to Aaron. Because Ahijah was old enough to be a warrior accompanying Saul, his father, Abitub, was no doubt over 30 years of age and serving with his father, Phinehas, and his grandfather, Eli. Ahitub would, during his time on duty, which would include some time to time being the substitute high priest with his grandfather, Eli and his father Phinehas, and his uncle, also Hophni, he would be able to wear that ephod from time to time. Now, at this point in the story, Ahijah was not old enough to wear this ephod. So 26 years later, when Ahijah was at least 46 years of age, his uncle, by the name of Ichabod, is going to be born on the day of his grandfather, grandmother, granduncle, great-grandfather's deaths. We are not told that Ahitub continued as priest, but surely he did because he was old enough to be the priest. No doubt Samuel, who had been told of the deaths of Eli's son when he was just a boy, 26 years from this point in the story, will be at least 60 years of age. He will anoint Zadok as the new high priest, thus eliminating forever Ahijah's ability to ever become the high priest of Israel, which fulfilled the promise of the Lord to Eli concerning the end of the family of Eli being the high priestly line. Third and quickly, when the writer says, "And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone," he was indicating that Jonathan was acting completely on his own, except for the company of his lone, faithful armor bearer. Jonathan was truly stepping out on his own without the approval of the king, his father, or any other Israelite in the nation.